Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
With COVID still causing disruption around the world, we're now being hit with shortages, and with that, inflation. The Federal Reserve and other central banks are saying it's only transitory, so don't worry about it. Prices will stop growing as quickly soon. But are they right on that, or will shortages be with us for some time? And if so, who suffers the most? We know it's not going to be the supremely wealthy, so how do we stop the recovery being one that makes life much more expensive for those who can least afford it? Is inflation the next pandemic? That's today on the Debunking Economics podcast with Professor Steve Keane. I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. Well, COVID is taking a long time to go away, isn't it? Around the world, there's still 500,000 new cases a day. They're just the ones that we know about, of course. You know, there'll be a lot in Africa and other parts of the world that we don't know about. There's almost 10 million active cases that we do know about in the United States. So one in 30 people in the United States right now have it. Now, the vaccine does seem to be helping. Somewhere around 150 people a day are dying from it in the UK. Back in January, before we all had the vaccine, that number is around 1,800. So that's a hell of a difference. But still, 1.3 million people are infected in the UK. That is 70% of that January peak. So it's still around. So even with the infections and the vaccinations, people are still getting sick. And in America, well over 8 million people out of work compared with 5 million before the pandemic. So 3 million to go before they get back to where they were. And yet, you know, they probably would have thought 5 million unemployed wasn't a staggering figure anyway. And yet central banks are making noises about getting back to normal, easing off quantitative easing, lifting interest rates. Not immediately in most cases, but they are talking about their roadmap. In New Zealand, they are about to lift interest rates. The Norges Bank in Norway has lifted interest rates. So, Steve, at the last meeting, the Bank of England made noises about lifting rates because they were worried about inflation. But we all know why prices are rising in the United Kingdom. I mean, are they living on a different planet?
Planet neoclassical. That's the problem. It's been interesting to watch Danny Blanchflower, actually, if you ever read Danny Blanchflower's stuff on Twitter. He was a member of the Monetary Policy Committee. And I'm not sure of Danny's actual intellectual background. He's clearly an economist, but he is not slaven to the mainstream way of thinking. And he just rubbishes Mervyn King and everybody else on the committee, I think with one exception, having their heads in the textbook clouds rather than their feet on the real world ground. And in 2008, putting up interest rates because they thought there was they had to restrain runaway inflation. Well, of course, what hit them was the biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression. So their capacity to see what their models tell them is going to happen rather than what's happening in the real world, and if I were to see what's happening in credit markets, because the blinkers that are welded onto the heads of neoclassical economists in first year at university is amazing. So, yeah, they live on a different planet.
But you don't have to be an academic to figure this out. I mean, we've got supply chains.
Yeah, but it helps not to be one to figure it out.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, the man in the street will be getting confused by this because they'd be looking and going, okay, so we've got supply chains disrupted globally. On top of that, we've got a shortage of drivers locally. So we are actually seeing food disappearing from shelves. It's certainly pushing up food prices. Then we've got food not being picked because we've not got enough itinerant workers because of people like you, Steve Keane, arguing that we should leave Europe. Then we've got energy. I'm always going to dig that one in. Then we've got how's it working out for you, by the way? Then we've got energy prices rising
pretty well over into Thailand.
Exactly. Sorry. If you're not in this country, absolutely. Energy prices rising, of course, astronomically. Tax rises to come. We've got the IR35 rules. So self-employed workers basically broadly now pay the same income tax and national insurance contributions, which is in effect a price hike for a wage cut, I should say, for those people who are not directly employed. Add to all of that an interest rate rise, then the economy, I mean, it's just like we've got a perfect storm already. Let's just make matters worse. I mean, most people would say, Are they nuts?
Well, the answer is yes.
Yeah. So is it that? Or because, as you know, I also do a podcast every day for the National Australia Bank, the NAB Morning Call, and I talk to analysts from the bank. Their read on all of this is that the Bank of England is just talking the talk, but they're never going to walk the walk. In other words, they're going to tell people that this is what they're thinking of, but it's never going to happen. They're really just trying to pacify the markets or pacify the neoclassical economists, I guess.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's an interesting division in central banks between the board and the research staff sometimes. Like in the American system, it seems that the research staff become the board. You get people like, you know, Ben Bernanke, who's a professor of economics and wrote, he writes one of the leading textbooks, becomes the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Greenspan was actually an exception on that front. He was, a Wall Street speculator, not an academic, but Yellen is another person who was an academic. So in America, the academics get to run the show. In UK, it seems to be sort of well-respected members of the City of London who get to run the place, but they are normally trained in mainstream economics anyway. And sometimes why they got the position there is because that's recognised by the people who nominate them. So, yeah, they're wearing a set of blinkers, and the blinker tells them that everything is driven by what they call inflationary expectations. And they say, oh, there's going to be a rise in expectations of inflation, and that will cause a rise in inflation. So we have to put up interest rates twice as fast as the expectations are rising, and that'll push them back the other direction.
Right. Irrespective of what's actually happening right now. But I guess the people are looking at all of those things and would be saying, oh, well, prices are going to go up even more. And so what they're saying, well, okay, if you've got that, I mean, I can sort of half understand the logic. If you've got a whole load of people saying, well, look, prices are bad, but they're going to get worse, and they go, well, I tell you what, we're going to stop them getting worse because we're going to tell you that we're going to do this, and that will keep prices subdued, then people might go, oh, well, that's not so bad then, and then maybe they don't have to actually lift rates. I've heard this argument before. Just the threat that they're going to do it makes people lower their expectations for inflation, therefore that doesn't happen. I mean, it's a twisted logic, but you could sort of, like, behaviourally, you could see that sort of thing happening.
That's what they're doing. But, I mean, again, when you look at all this stuff, you've got to go back to Milton, Bloody Friedman, and the original paper he wrote called The Optimum Quantity of Money, back in 1953. And an essential part of that argument was that you would have inflation with absolutely no change. It would be in equilibrium with inflation. And the idea was that it, normally you think inflation is actual prices rising, and people look at actual prices, and then they realise there's inflation, and then you are in a non-equilibrium position, and then the inflation pushes you back into equilibrium again. That's the sort of way that neoclassicals used to think before Friedman turned up. And what he did in this paper is say, well, just imagine there's a helicopter flying over the country. And if you start with 1,000 dollar notes, okay? I'll use £1, but, $1,000, £1, whatever, flying over the country. There's £1,000 in circulation, which are notes labelled, this is $1 each, 1,000 of them. And then one day a helicopter flies over the country and drops another 1,000 notes. Now, the point that you left out of the logic, well, it would have to be a Federal Reserve or a Bank of England helicopter, because they dropped over the country, they'd be forgery.
But his point was, if that kept on happening, then you start to assume it was going to keep on happening, and therefore you'd devalue. You'd assume money's worth less.
Yeah, people grab them, pick them up initially, think there's been an increase in demand because there are more pieces of paper flowing around, but ultimately return to the original full employment equilibrium. And this is the nonsense thing in thinking. He presumes that Keynesian style policies, which is what he's attacking in this paper, are trying to drive the employment rate below the market equilibrium, where the market equilibrium is actually an optimum. So we're not talking, thinking in terms of the Great Depression, 30% of the workforce out of a job, which is where Keynesian policies actually began, and only a lunatic His name, by the way, is Finn Kittland and Edward Prescott. Only lunatics would think that was an equilibrium situation. And therefore, you're well and truly away from where with much higher unemployment than the market would give if the market was functioning properly. And then you therefore boost demand to get you to the point where the unemployment falls. That's the world of the actual way in which situation in which Keynes's ideas became the mainstream. But he just says, let's assume we're in full employment, and then the government tries to give us over full employment. Well, gee, that'll cause inflation. Well, there's not an economist on the planet who would disagree with that, but it's the assumption you start from the optimum and try to push past the optimum. That's the nonsense bit, that the sleight of hand that Friedman dropped in.
His natural rate of unemployment. And the question is, what is that? Because if you look at, non-accelerating inflation rate of employment, NARU.
Unemployment,
which was over 7% back in the 80s. It's been, around 5% for quite a while. The unemployment rate in the US now is 5.2%. So, you could say job done. I mean, there's 8 million people out of work, but you could say, look, the job's been done by the Fed because they've lowered their NARU and it's all good now.
But the point is he snuck in this idea that expectations cause rising prices. That was the trick in that writing, and he said therefore you've got to break those expectations. The people who followed him were even more lunatic than Friedman was. That's why I mentioned Finn Kittland and Edward Prescott, who gave us what are called real business cycle models, and they went even further and argued that things like the Great Depression were an equilibrium reaction of the workforce to some change in labour regulations. So people voluntarily worked less, and that's what we recorded during the Great Depression as a rise in unemployment, because they decided it wasn't worth their while to go and work at the offering wage, so they might as well go back to their farms and their personal workshops and make their own stuff for themselves. Delusional garbage, but this is what becomes pumped into the heads of mainstream economic thinkers, and they are the ones who end up making the decisions for central banks. So they're looking at the real world. The rest of us are taking into account things like massive levels of private debt, obvious supply chain disruptions, potential approach of climate change, all this sort of stuff, and saying, well, this is not a situation of rampant aggregate demand dragging up prices. If you have this situation where it's supply chain disruptions that are causing the rising prices, and you then hit the market with something which actually reduces aggregate demand, you're not going to cause a adjustment just to the price system. You're going to crash demand itself. And this is the fear that a lot of us have. This sort of thing will end up causing a slump.
And I don't know how you position yourself, because Jerome Powell from the Fed, in his chair of the Fed, in his defense, is saying this is the inflation that we're seeing is all transitory. It is all driven by supply constraints. So my reaction to that would be, well, okay, inflation is going higher and higher and higher, but it's transitory. Jerome Powell is telling me in a year's time it will have all gone away. So guess what? I'm not going to spend money on stuff right now. I might negotiate for a higher wage in the short term, but the stuff that I really want to buy, particularly big items, I'll leave it till next year when inflation has gone away. But that's subduing. Yeah. So he's trying to get himself over that path, but he is subduing demand by his words, and I think we're seeing a bit of that already in the US economy.
No, it's the difficult thing with the situation we're in now. When I look back at the 70s, the thing which was special about the 70s was, first of all, there was an absolute gangbusters boom going on. 1973 was possibly the peak level for economic activity on the planet in terms of how much of the workforce was employed and how little slack there was in the productive sectors of the economy. And then you had a supply shock from after the Yom Kippur War, the blockade that the OPEC put on supporters of Israel, which meant you had a quadrupling of the oil price from $2.50 a barrel to $10. And that happened, and there's another one again, which is more market-driven, in 79, it went from $10 to $40. And then at that stage, because that was a supply-driven inflation hit. But at the same time, you had a far lower level of private debt, still high, but what it meant was that corporations who were you know, coping with a very, very high level of demand in the economy, were willing to extend their lines of credit to pay the higher prices for the oil. And then you had workers organized into trade unions. They still existed in America back then, who would use the very high demand for labor at the time to demand a continuing wage rises. And then you had this huge the flow through from the supply pressure pushing up prices became demand pressure pushing up prices, and you got the classic supply push demand pull inflationary spiral that gave us the high inflation up to about, well, I think about 17% per year in America before Voelker got in charge. So that was the situation back then. And when Voelker hit the brakes, he put interest rates up to something, I think it was 20%, was huge in that environment. And what that meant was that thumped investment. So like I will normally say interest rate is pretty much irrelevant to the rate of investment, but you whack it up from 12% to 20%, the sort of change we went through, bang, that'll say to people, we're not going to repay this debt quite possibly. So bang, investment collapses. And then what you've got is this momentum still of the supply demand cycle of price rises still in the system, but you've hit the economy in literally in the guts with the interest rate rise and investment collapses. So then you've got rising prices and falling economy, otherwise known as stagflation.
Got the capex going, so production production's cut, so arguably prices will go even higher because there's less of what people are demanding, and then demand will eventually fall because people are going, well, it's too bloody expensive anyway.
And in one thing which, coming from a non-neoclassical perspective on everything, the non-mainstream argument about what inflation actually involves from is effectively class struggle. The neoclassical say it's expectations of inflation with these representative agents, all this nonsense stuff that they, fantasy stuff that they think is hard-nosed, they fill their models with. From a post-Keynesian, just right out to Marxist point of view, you've got a struggle between workers and capitalists and bankers over the distribution of income. And if that can't be resolved at current prices, then current prices rise because the workers putting up their wages meets capitalists who put up their wages without put up their prices without reducing their margins because they're confident they can still sell at the higher prices. Now, the situation we're in now, I don't think there'd be plenty of manufacturers out there who've got supply pressure forcing them to put up prices. Are they confident they're going to get the demand to meet them? No. So you therefore have a potential for them to cut their margin rather than put up the prices. And that will mean, first of all, you dampen out the rise in inflation. And secondly, the problem is income distribution. A weakened working class, no unions to help organise them.
Yeah.
Initially, they might get the wage rises, but they're all in a living hand to mouth.
Well, will they get those wage rises? Or will, where the companies are saying, well, let's try and ride inflation by cutting costs. So, well, we'll cut costs because we won't put up wages as much. And people are, we've got unemployment's rife, so people haven't got any negotiating power. Well, I haven't got a union anyway.
Or they try to cut their margins to survive with a lower margin. So, but what you'll get out of it, I think we'll actually see lots and lots of price rises coming out of it. But the impact of the price rises will be that those products are no longer something workers can put in their shopping basket.
Yeah, so demand's going to fall.
But you'll record it. See, initially you'll record it as a high rate of inflation because you'll have a distribution of income that determines a certain pattern of commodity purchases, and that's the basket that goes together to make up the consumer price index.
Mm.
Then if this means as workers simply can no longer afford to buy a car every, let's say, 10 years, and they've got to make it every 15 or 20 in their calculations, and a whole lot of other stuff just has to go out of the shopping basket, then you'll still be recording the inflation. But It'll actually be manifest as a drop in demand for these items.
Yeah.
And then ultimately, you have to readjust it. Oh, dear, we overcalculated the rate of inflation back when the crisis was hitting.
Right. But it's volume of goods sold, which is going to be the thing that's going to take the hit, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the thing. It's going to hit a quantity effect, not a price effect. And they're used to living in a world where all this stuff determines price effects while quantities are independent.
So, but you described the scenario where you get spiraling upwards inflation, where prices of goods go up, workers say, well, we've got to pay more so we can afford those things. That pushes labor costs up, that pushes the cost of goods up, so therefore they go, hey, look, we need more money again. And so it goes onwards, upwards and upwards. How do you break that spiral? I mean, some people would say...
It's already broken. This is the point. It's already broken.
Because people can't negotiate to increase their wages?
Because you don't have the... if I mention the Teamsters, people are going to think I'm talking about a rock group these days. The strong labor organizations like the Teamsters in the USA, the Amalgamated Metal Workers, which I've occasionally done consulting for in Australia... All these strong unions just don't exist anymore. So the negotiation isn't there. The only way you get a wage rise is if there's such labour shortage, for whatever reason at the moment, it's the pandemic, that employers are willing to outbid each other to offer higher wages. But the moment the pressure is gone, they'll reverse that bid. So you don't have the same permanence of wage rises hitting into inflation anymore.
Inflation has to keep on rising, of course, doesn't it? Because it's prices can go up and you can have high inflation, then it can level off and then you've got zero inflation. So, I mean, that could happen with jobs, couldn't it? Because lots of people lost their jobs and now there's lots of people out of work and there's demand for those people. So employers are having to pitch for them. And we all know if you work for the same company all your life, like my brother, I've got a great classic example. I've got one brother who just worked for the same company all his life and he hardly ever got any pay increases. Mm. Whereas, in my career, when it was blossoming all those years ago, I'd go from one job to another and get 50% more because I'd done well in the last job. And I knew if I'd stayed in that job, they'd go, oh, you've done well, here's 3%. But if you go and apply for another job, you step up the ladder. So people are doing that now, I think, aren't they? But that's only, again, it's only a transitory thing. So we're going to see wages go up because people are moving around and finding jobs and there's the sectors where the demand is greater, so they're going to pay more. But I don't think those prices will go down. Those wages will go down. Pretty hard to tell someone that they're going to have to take a pay cut. But they're not going to keep on rising. So wage push inflation will slightly reduce to zero.
But at the same time, you're going to continue getting the supply chain disruptions. I mean, we're getting out of the COVID one to some extent. This is just one of many coming our way.
You're seeing like the Brexit oil one, Steve.
Uh-huh. Self-inflicted. Okay. This is getting as bad as the bloody Australian property prices garbage to get back in Australia. But anyway.
Yeah, you're going to we'll talk about that next time. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's what you knocked me off my bloody train of thought. Where was I going?
I was talking about wage push inflation, and you were talking about how, we've still got the supply constraints, so we've still got inflation.
They'll come on two things. Climate change, but also we're starting to see real shortages in physical minerals and in energy. And this is what's in it. The latter is known as the Hubert Peak. That we've passed the point of peak oil production. Conventional, we passed that at least 20 years ago. It looks like we're also past the peak of production of shale oil and fracking and stuff like that as well. So we're running out of supply of oil. And oil is essentially liquid energy, and energy is by far the most essential input to production processes. So you're finding that you now have to, if firms are bidding to get hold of the energy, and that's going to mean the oil prices rise. But the impact overall is not that we're going to pay more and consume the same volume. We're going to pay more and consume less, and therefore there'll be production shortages again, which will turn up in price rises for parts of the economy, but by those outputs as inputs.
And the people obviously are going to suffer the most. They're going to be the poor, the less well off, because a higher proportion of their income goes on those basic commodities that we all need to survive. So monetary policy isn't going to help them, obviously. So should the government step in and support them? Should that be the focus now by stopping the impact of inflation hurting those people? So if you're, I guess I'm asking you this question, Steve, if you're a politician, perish the thought, imagine that. Mm-hmm. If you're a politician, what would you do to tackle this issue where you've got inflation hurting the poor because of, for whatever reason, but in this case, it's because of those supply constraints?
I'd be looking at a basic income.
Right.
Because I'm in favour of the idea of a job guarantee as well, but I think a lot of this stuff presumes a continuation of the capacity to produce at the scale we have on the planet for the last 50 years, and that isn't there anymore. We again actually want to have some people not going to work because we want to reduce how much is being produced. We don't want people to starve to death because of it.
So right, but isn't that, wouldn't that make inflation worse then?
Quite possibly, yeah.
Because you'd be producing even less. And so the demand for those...
Yeah, I can't see any happy way out of this that results in a return to the growth levels of the 50s and 60s. And I think it's what let's go back to growth is sort of the backdrop here. It is just too effed up a world for that to be possible.
But whatever you do, it sounds like you're going to have runaway inflation. So we've got a shortage of supplies now because the supply chains have all been broken. You're saying, well, you know, on an ongoing basis, we have to get used to that. Then there's nothing there that's going to stop inflation. And so the Fed's there saying we've got, you know, the acceptable inflation rate of around 2%, possibly a bit lower. So, I mean, first of all, where did they get that number from? Is there a magic number? And isn't it because of those constraints that you're talking about, you know, demand and supply constraints, isn't that number just going to keep on rising?
Well, it could. What I think you're going to see is a whole range of commodities that workers have been used to consume, and middle class have been used to consume, that gets priced out of their possibility of buying it. And this was actually the impact of rising prices in the Arabic countries. We have what we call the Arab Spring, set off by a Tunisian market workers self-immolating over price rises. It becomes impossible for ordinary people to buy, you know, commodities they need to survive. Things, you know, in that situation, including, you know, oil for heating and oil and therefore, bang, they went on riot, and you finally had the political upheavals of the 2000s and 10s and thereabouts in the in Arabic countries. So I don't think you can avoid that level of political conflict, unfortunately. It will manifest itself as inflation, but then the commodities where it's becoming outrageously high and which are not essential items
demand
will disappear from workers' shopping baskets. No. It's the ones that are left in there, and then you start seeing people getting, you know, to the stage where what was their comfortable living becomes barely subsistence. Then you're likely to see, you know, the equivalent of the Arab Spring in the West.
Or a Karl Marx revolution. Maybe that's...
Yeah, I know there's a lot of students. You know, the youth are sort of pro-socialism in a way that terrifies the older cohort in America, and they're wondering why.
So how does where we are now compare with the 1970s? Because obviously we had a fuel crisis in the 1970s. We had the three-day week and all that sort of stuff with oil prices going through the roof. And obviously inflation was rising as a result of that. How does where we are now compare with then?
The thing about the 70s, the reason it's scarred the minds of economists who both teach economics and make economic policy these days, it was that they had the combination of rising unemployment and rising prices, and that was supposed to have broken the belief in Keynes's model. Allegedly, this couldn't happen in Keynes. What they meant was it couldn't happen in Phillips, which was the idea of the Phillips curve. And Phillips was an engineer. He wasn't stupid enough to be an economist. He was trying to reform economics. And he put together a model of prices, a model of the economy, which was a non-equilibrium supply, the stuff I build in Minsky.
Yeah.
He was doing it 60, 70 years ago, you know. And as part of that, he argued that when you had high demand, you would have high rate of change of what he called factor prices. And he meant both commodity prices, you know, prices for machines, prices for wages for workers, all that sort of stuff. And then to make the case that this, he actually literally drew it But being an engineer, having drawn something, he went to check and see whether it exists, unlike economists. And he did a study of about 80 years of English data of the rate of inflation and the rate of change of money wages. And he then found exactly the sort of relationship he hypothesized. But what he said was there were three factors that he saw as leading to changes in workers' wage demands. One was the level of unemployment. Second was the rate of change of unemployment. And the third was cost pressures due to supply shocks. Effectively, he's talking about imported goods, but fundamentally, with leading to a wage price spiral. That's actually literally those words are in Phillips. Now, neoclassicals, A, don't read the bloody stuff. They read what's written in a textbook. They don't see that he said it was a nonlinear function. They use straight bloody lines. And they leave out the other two causal factors. Now, the reason that Phillips himself left those causal factors out is he was doing all the work on a bland, bloody hand-operated calculator, and he had annual data for one country on two time series, and even that was too much. That gave him about like 80 data points to key in. That was too much, so he simplified it by dividing the unemployment into seven ranges. So he had seven data points. Now, if you have, if you're trying to undercover an underlying process, which is extremely complex, you know, level of unemployment, rate of change of unemployment, and then supply shocks coming in from overseas, and you have seven data points, you can fit Winnie the Pooh to that if you have a three-dimensional. So he just fed it to the first and left the other two out of the statistics, but it was still in his thinking. Well, this has been completely degraded by neoclassicals over time. They made a caricature of Phillips's work, and that's what today drives their discussions around central boards, central bank board meetings.
Yeah, and it's really, I mean, what they've done is that they've not talked about a systematic approach at all, have they? They've taken a snapshot. It's the inflation rate and unemployment rate at any one point. So move one way and the other one goes the other way. It's
Yeah, there's no dynamics to their thinking, whereas Phillips is quintessentially about modelling a dynamic process.
Yeah.
He made one verbal slip. He did argue that there was sort of a menu. You know, if you wanted 2%, pardon me, rate of inflation, you did a 5% rate of unemployment. You know, because you could choose, if you chose one, you chose the other along a trade-off line. And that was a slip of the tongue, which he shouldn't have made, but he did. And then after, he said if he knew the way his work would have been treated, he would never have done it.
And that is all the more complicated now for what we've been discussing in the last half hour, that supply is being constrained. And so that throws another dynamic into the whole equation, doesn't it? And that's a global phenomenon, because if we look at inflation around the world, it's hard. I mean, okay, there are periods when inflation was rising more or less in unison in most of the developed world, but really everyone had their own peaks and troughs. This is really the first time, I think, that we've actually had inflation rising almost everywhere. I mean, you know, there's some countries which have managed to avoid it so far, but it's because, of course, it is a global constraint on supply that we're seeing.
Well, this isn't, not so much. I mean, the same thing applied in the 70s as well, but the difference is that the demand is more broadly spread these days. So in the 1970s, you didn't have to worry about competition from China for supply of oil. Okay, now you do. So it isn't so much a class struggle anymore. It's become a country's struggle to make sure you get the resources for your own people ahead of it. And I think this is going to signal more changes like this over time, because politically, politicians answer the people in their own country, and if it looks like their own people are going to be revolting over shortages that mean that they don't have basic essential commodities, then if you're the supplier of those essential commodities, you're likely to stop doing it. If you're a buyer, you're likely to try to buy out the competition, if that's possible. So Not exactly a stable system. Gee, I think we should abandon the use of the word equilibrium. What do you reckon?
It sounds like, Well, I don't know why you've not mentioned it before. So let's finish off where we start then. So we've got central banks now talking about easing off on their quantitative easing. So quantitative tightening, in other words. Yeah. I mean, that's a discussion for another day. But then doing that so that they can start lifting interest rates because of inflation, which obviously, you know, as we've explained, is the wrong thing to do. Or should they? So should they be keeping interest rates? Because, I mean, they're doing damage with quantitative easing and interest rates at zero or less than zero. I mean, surely it's going to be healthy for interest rates to. I mean, we've talked before, interest rates almost should be fixed. You know, a couple of percent sounds like a good idea.
Well, the funny thing is that there's actually a brilliant book on statistics called Data Reduction by a guy called Ehrenberg, written way back in the 50s or 60s. I unfortunately lost it by lending to a student. I've never seen it since. I think I actually managed to find an online version. Anyway, he took a, as a statistician looking at how badly economists had done their own work on statistics, he took as an example of a constant the interest rate.
Right.
He modelled, again, the changes according to distribution of income rather than the interest rate as a control variable. But the point is, looking at the data, it made obvious sense for him to treat the interest rate as a constant because when he looked over time, it had been about 3%. So the whole period of massively rising interest rates and high inflation, that is a distinctly post-World War phenomenon. It's something which you only see happening sort of starting in the 60s and 70s. But if you and we had no periods of deflation in America before we hit the Great Recession, when inflation went from plus 5 to minus 2%. But if you look back in the 1800s, you see patterns of inflation and deflation all the way through. Yeah. And
so what you're saying is it makes no difference. We've got a bunch of predominantly middle-aged white men earning a handsome salary sitting in central banks all over the world, feeling like they're doing some very important work, but actually they're probably doing nothing at all.
Yep, pretty close. Actually worse.
All right. Okay, we'll leave it there for now. Look, we'll catch you again next time. Good to talk, Steve.
Okay, bye. Yep.
And next time, which will just be in a few days' time, you might have heard that Steve is standing for the Senate in Australia. He's standing for the new Liberal Party. Next time, we'll find out why he's doing, what would possess him to enter the world of politics, and what do the new Liberals stand for, and has he got a cat in hell's chance of being voted in? All of those questions and many more next time on the Debunking Economics Podcast with Steve Keen. I'm Phil Dobby. See you then.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y-Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y-Curve in your favourite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.